This is Pocket Watching with JT, the call-in financial talk show focused on helping you get your money right. Jason Thornton is a certified financial planner, licensed in both tax and investments. Now, this is not personal financial advice. This is JT's real reaction to all your money and business questions. Are you deep in debt, living paycheck to paycheck, and looking for a way out? Call Pocket Watching with JT, the financial advisor for the people. Need more? Book your personal consultation with my man JT at pocketwatcher.net. Now, let's go pocket watching.
Hey, Pocket Watchers, welcome to Pocket Watching with JT. It is the Monday night live stream. So big shout out to the nearly 60,000 of you who hit that red subscribe button. I appreciate it. For those of you who haven't done it yet, I don't know what you're waiting for. Go ahead and hit that subscribe button, hit the like button, and share this content. So it is Money Mondays. This is where we do the live question and answer financial show. So if you have a personal financial question, a business question, whatever it is, you can give me a call, 515-602-9778. That's 515-602-9778. I will do the best I can to answer your questions and try to point you in the right direction of how you can better yourself financially. Now, I do have the questions that you guys submit to me online. So for whatever reason, if you are unable to give the Pocket Watcher a call and you missed the show, maybe your schedule is different, you can't catch the show live or call in live, don't worry about that. You can always go to my website. You can go to pocketwatcher.net. That is pocketwatcher.net. Click on the Ask JT button and you can fill out a very short survey. Basically, let me know what's your name, where you're from, and what is your financial question, and I will try to help you out. Now, well, you got a caller already there. Hold on, caller from 323 area code. Hold on 1 second. I'm going to bring you on. I just want to make sure we cover a few things before I bring on the caller and I go over the very many. I mean, I've got 22 pages of questions that people submitted online. Now, I'm most likely not going to get through all 22 pages this show. I'll do the best I can to get through the questions that I can, and whatever questions that I left on the table, I'll kick off to another show, but I'll do the best I can to answer these questions. So real quick, before you call up, you have to have an understanding of what my philosophy is and who I am. All right. I am Jason Thornton, CFP. I am a certified financial planner. I am a licensed financial advisor. Most of my practice starting up dealt with IRS controversy issues. I represent clients before the IRS for collections, appeals, even tax settlements. So got a lot of experience with dealing with the IRS, negotiating with the IRS, fighting the IRS on behalf of my clients. So if you have tax questions, that is very, very easy for me to work with. But also, obviously, if you have personal financial planning questions, I'm a CFP. If you have issues with budgeting, if you have issues with paying down your debt, if you have questions about investing and how to save for retirement, I can most likely, I'm gearing towards like 99% here, I'm pretty sure I can point you in the right direction to help you out. All right. Just want to put that on the table. That's what we're doing tonight. And I want to thank everybody who showed up last week on Friday when I did my very first broadcast from the radio station News Talk STL. So for those of you who don't know, I have a partnership with a local radio station here in the city of St. Louis. For my YouTube viewers, nothing really changes for you. But on Friday nights at 8 p.m. Central Standard Time, because that's the time I do my live streams on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 8 p.m. Central Standard Time. But on Fridays, I will actually be doing that show live on the radio and live streaming on YouTube. Phone number is going to stay the same for you guys, so not a big difference for you, but we'll have some new audience coming in from the radio station. So we should have fun with that. And of course, on Wednesdays, I'm still going to be me and my brother Orlando Minor holding down the Wednesday night live stream. All right, so got some callers here. So callers have the first priority, and then I'm gonna try to get through these 22 pages of questions from the pocket watches out there. So here we go. We have a caller from 323 area code first, and after 323, we got caller from 202. So here we go. Caller from 323 area code. You are live on the air with Pocket Watching with JT. How can I help you?
Good evening, JT. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for calling.
Oh, great, great. I have a question for you. I have some friends of mine who's concerned about funeral expenses for the elderly mother. Mm-hmm. And I want to find out, do you know anything about these life insurances that they have advertised on TV, like the $9.95 a month with no medical or health history? What are the pros and cons of that, and mm-hmm. what are alternatives to that if somebody don't really have money to pay for a funeral?
Right. See, I'm not a big fan. I'm aware of those type of insurance policies. Personally, I'm not a big fan of buying insurance that has to be paid for a particular thing, right? For those of you who have ever bought a home, when you bought your first home or your second home or whatever, you will find out very shortly that all of a sudden you are going to get a lot of mail talking about buying insurance for your mortgage. So just in case if you were to die, you then have an insurance policy that can pay off your mortgage. Well, I'm not a big fan of that. I'd rather have term life insurance, right? That I can then have my beneficiaries to get that money. And if they choose to pay off the mortgage, they can pay off the mortgage. But if they need to use the money for something else, they can use it for something else. And I feel the same way about these type of policies that are designated for a particular thing. Not a huge fan of that. Normally, what I would suggest, and I have a very close friend, an actual fraternity brother of mine in the St. Louis area, who is, you know, he owns a funeral home. Young guy, you know, about the same age as me, young guy, but he owns a funeral home. And they mm-hmm. do have programs where you can just simply prepay for the services, and you can set up a payment arrangement with the particular funeral home of your choosing. So I would most likely, in my situation, things that I tell my personal clients and even my close friends and family, to me, it makes more sense to have a relationship with the particular funeral home that you would designate for yourself or a loved one that you're going to work with, and work out a prepayment plan for those services. And you could probably work out a pretty good deal with them on that also. So I would go with that rather than going with the insurance policy. I'm just not a big fan of insurance policies that are designated for a particular expense rather than something that you can leave to your beneficiaries with options. Does that make sense?
Okay, so these things, you can't buy it and leave money to your beneficiaries. It's not designed for that. I don't know anything about
it. Yeah, I mean, for the policies that I'm aware of, these policies are just for your funeral arrangements. Now, if you can find a policy that is like a term life policy or something like that, where the death benefit goes to the beneficiary and you can do whatever what you want with the money, but you would spend a certain portion on the funeral arrangements, then okay, that makes sense. But I'm not a fan of getting a policy where you have to spend it on a particular thing.
Okay. I got you.
Yeah.
Okay, so would a term life, term life, would that be something that a senior can get?
It would be extremely expensive. It would be so expensive if the only reason mm-hmm. you're going to be getting life insurance is to help pay for the funeral arrangements. You're better off just working out a prepayment arrangement with the funeral home that you're going to go through anyway. Right. If you're at the point, right, and I'm speaking generally to anybody, if you're at the point right. where you're trying to find a way to fund and pay for funeral arrangements, then we already got a pretty good idea. These arrangements are not going to be pretty extravagant. It's not going to be an expensive funeral because you're looking for right. ways to fund it. So if you already know you're going to have somewhat of a minimum type of funeral arrangement, then let's go ahead and figure out what is it going to cost. Contact, you know, local funeral homes. Figure out which one makes the most sense for you. Figure out what's the total cost going to be. And then they can probably go ahead and set you up on a payment plan, fixed in costs, and then set up a payment plan to just get that done. But the bank on insurance, because think about what you're, you know, what you're trying to do, like conceptually. You're trying to pay a few insurance premium payments that's going to pay out way more than what the actual cost is going to be for the funeral, right? So you're trying to figure out, it's like, that's not beneficial to the insurance company. Why would the insurance company do that? Like, okay. It looks like they're going to pay a grand total of $3,000 in premiums, but the policy is going to pay off like $12,000 for this funeral. Well, how does the insurance company make money off that? It doesn't seem right. So I would go the route of just trying to find a company where you can set up a prepayment plan for the services.
Okay. Yeah. I understand that. Okay, thank you. I really appreciate your help.
Absolutely. You have a good one, all right?
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
All right, bye. All right. Going to caller from the 202 area code. Caller from 202, you are live on the air with Pocket Watching with JT. Thank you for calling.
JT, what's good, man? It's Debt-Free Dad. It's
Debt-Free Dad.
It's a good opportunity for me to get some free guidance from you, brother.
All right, well, let's see. Let's see if I'm up to the task. What's going on?
All right, I got two things I want to ask, and each one related to repayment of my student loan, right? So the first question is, started out two student loans. My wife's was $130,000. Mine was $109,000. Well, during this period of not having no interest, mine is probably going to be about $25,000 by the time payments resume, you know, if they resume next year, you know. So it'll be about $25,000.
Okay.
So I have a couple of options, right? One option is, you know, just when the payments resume as normal, I'm paying interest rates on my wife, I think, is 6. Mine's at about 4 and some change. Option number one is just pay the minimum on hers. Everything else goes towards mine. Or option number two, put hers in forbearance and just pay the interest on hers and then knock mine's out really fast, then move to hers.
Okay, what's the balances again? What's the balance on yours and the balance on hers?
By the time loans start back up, when interest start back up, I'll probably have, worst case scenario, probably about $30,000 left on mine's, and hers is at $130,000. But we just jumped on mine's first because it was $109,000. It was the smallest one, so we said, let's just go ahead and knock that one out.
Okay. I mean, if we're going like the debt snowball method, it would make the most sense to do the minimum payment on hers and you really kick it into high gear in getting yours completely paid off. Once yours is completely paid off, you can then roll all of that into going very, very hard on paying hers off. Even though her interest rate is higher, it makes more sense because the momentum that you'll be able to have and the energy that you'll be able to have knowing that you were able to pay yours off is going to allow you to keep going to knock hers off. Now, how much money do you have freely available to throw at this $30,000 of yours?
Typically, on a real strong month, it would be with no random surprises popping up. We're talking anywhere between $300 to $3,400. We have $3,000 to $3,400 we've been putting on it.
Okay, and you have an emergency savings fund?
Yeah. We got about 5 months of emergency stashed away, and we got an account on autopilot, a set amount that just goes to that fund because we're trying to get it up to, you know, 6 to 9 months. So it just that's kind of on autopilot outside of the extra that we're contributing to the student loan.
All right, and what type of budget are we looking at, right? Do you have a budget that is straight up, hey, I am focused on only paying the necessities, or do you have some fun money budgeted in there?
There's a little bit of fund money budgeted in there. I told you we did the whole FPU thing. That was the only way I could convince my wife to get on board because she didn't want to hear what I had to say. I had to let an old white guy tell her. But either way, it ended up working out. But we got a budget. We do got a little bit of fund money, you know, stashed away. You know, she got a couple dollars she can spend a month, and I do. I typically just probably invest mine because that's how I am.
You're an attorney. When you say a little bit of money, what is a little bit of money in the range of hundreds of dollars? What are we talking about here?
Isn't that bad? Percentage wise of the monthly income, my play money is 3% of what we make a month.
Yeah, but percentage wise don't mean nothing to me. I want to know dollar range.
she got about $400 to do whatever it is, and I got about $300. And I know with mines, I normally just invest mines or put it up into stocks or something like that.
I honestly, with me, I wouldn't even be investing. I would be just knocking out this debt. Get the debt down. As soon as possible, right? I talk about this all the time about the order of operations. While it feels good to go ahead and invest right now, you want to try to get that debt down as soon as possible and think what you can do with investing when the debt is gone.
See, that's a good segue, because my second question actually kind of pertains to that, right? Mm-hmm. The reason we didn't focus on it like that, because we were like, we'll just do a little bit on the student loans and focus on the investing. But probably a couple of years ago, we got to the point where we invested enough to, if we never invested another dime and just waited until we were 60, we would meet the dollar amount that we have identified as our minimum for retirement.
Okay.
So the other question is, where would you recommend it? And I know it'll be hard for me to do because it's just hard for me to wrap my mind around because it's a math thing, but would you ever say, damn, if you got your investments to that point where if you don't do anything else, you'll hit that minimum by 60, just cut off all investments and throw everything at that and just supercharge forward since we actually do got something invested. It's not like we don't have anything or never started. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, even before you got to that point, with the your investment account or being on that way, it's like I would have said before, stop doing the investments to try to get the debt down as soon as possible. Because here's the thing,
right?
We live in business cycles. There's going to be ups and downs, right? Most people, if they were looking at their 401k right now, is probably lower than it was about a year and a half to 2 years ago, right? I mean, I can guess that it's probably lower. Right. So as people are now looking at their investment portfolio and they're seeing it down by a certain percentage, and it's making them think like, oh, my God, what's going to happen? I mean, I know you know long term it's going to probably be higher. Right. So I know you don't have to think this way, but this is for the general public. It's like, yeah, you're looking at your investment portfolio. You see that it's down, but the debt isn't moving. The debt that you have didn't move. So your debt does not care about the stock market, right? Market can drop down by 20%, your debt is still growing. My advice is always, hey, let's go ahead and get that debt done with as soon as possible. Because when the market is down and I'm debt free, how much more can I buy at a lower price point? How much more can I buy on sale, right? Because to me, as a long-term investor, whenever the market's down, I'm not worried. I'm not going to retire for another 30, 35, maybe 40 years. So when the market is down, I'm rubbing my hands together because I know I get to buy the same stuff I was buying a day ago or a month ago at a lower price point. And if I'm debt-free, I can really go at it hard. But if you got this investment portfolio and you see it dip, 5, 10, 15, 20%, and you still got the debt, it doesn't make as much sense. So I would say, go ahead. If I was in your shoes, I would stop my investing. I would stop putting in until I can really get this debt out of the way. Everything but my mortgage. I am knocking and killing that debt all the way through. Because you look up, you know, 2-3 years, debt free. Now think how much money you can throw into a down market when you're debt free. Right. You'll make up for right. all what you feel as if you're losing by not getting right. in on the action now. You see what I'm saying? Right. And at the yeah. end of the day, the math will make sense because you'll have so much money to buy in a down market instead of on the margins of a couple hundred bucks. You'll be able to throw thousands of dollars comfortably, right? Not living on the right. edge. You'll be able to comfortably throw thousands of dollars in on a down market and watch that thing scale up by the time you hit your retirement.
Okay. All right. All right. Ooh, that's solid, man. I appreciate it, bro.
Absolutely. That is Debt-Free Dad, folks. Y'all go check his channel out. I believe I'm a subscriber to him. Y'all go check him out. Thanks. All right, people. We got caller from 678 area code coming up next. Caller from 678. Make sure whatever device you have me on that you're listening to, your phone, tablet, TV, or whatever, make sure you turn that down and you can talk to me straight through the phone. Here we go. Caller from 678 area code. You are live on the air with Pocket Watcher with JT.
Hey, JT. Am I clear?
Yeah, sound good. Yeah, sound good to me. Go right ahead.
Hey, JT, I love your show. I'm thinking back about one of your previous episodes where you were describing you deserve to live where you live, you know, and not to dwell on it about, you know, Los Angeles. Well, I was very fortunate. Back in 2017, I was able to purchase a home that I could afford. I was able to purchase it cash. Okay. I have no mortgage.
Good.
But the problem that I'm having now is the property taxes are getting ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I mean, year over year, it's going up. Almost not a little bit, but substantial. And it's affordable. I can pay it easily. It's no issues for me. But mm-hmm. I'm just thinking of the opportunity cost. And do I need to live here? Mm. You know, because the property taxes, to me, I don't feel like it's a waste of money. But I always question, I'm like, do I need to spend this amount of money every year mm-hmm. in property taxes? So I'm thinking, would it be a smart idea? I work remote, so I don't need to live here.
Right.
So my career wouldn't be adjusted. But would you, like, going back to your discussion about do I deserve to live here? Right. Do I deserve to live here? Because the taxes are ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So here's my general philosophy, right? For those of you who don't know what we're talking about here, my general philosophy is, like, what you have in life, like, right now, wherever you are, that's what you deserve. You don't deserve more without that extra work getting into to deserve more, especially when it comes to where you live. A lot of people have this mindset that if they're born in a certain city or there's a city that they always wanted to live in, that they deserve to live there. And if their current income isn't meeting the demands to live there, then the laws must be changed. Well, no, that's not how it works. You deserve to live where you can afford to live. And in your particular situation, yeah, I mean, you're able to live there, but you're now thinking about opportunity costs. You're spending so much money on the property taxes as they keep going up and up and up. And property taxes isn't some sort of investment, right? Property taxes is basically the rent that you're paying the government to allow to live there, to keep your home, right? That's the taxes that you're paying is basically your rent that you're paying the government saying thank you for allowing me to own this property. And there's very little that you can do to get around that. My only question is, what is the trade-off, right? And here's what I'm talking about with trade-offs. If you do move to a new location, are you going to overpay for a home? If you do move to a new location where the property tax is going to be lower, are you sacrificing certain things like to school district for your children and stuff like that? That's the things I want to make sure you're evaluating before you pull the trigger on the decision of moving out, because at the end of the day, is it better to go ahead and pay the current property taxes that you're paying, the current real estate tax that you pay, because relocating somewhere else is going to be, yeah, a cheaper real estate tax, but are you, you know, losing when it comes to the amenities and the things that kind of make life worth living in another area? If that's the same, if you can move somewhere else with less tax and you still have a good quality amenities within that locality, then to me, it's almost a no-brainer. I'd rather move. And think about it, every time that your property tax is going up, the telltale sign means the actual appreciation of your home. They're basically telling you that your home is worth more. And if the property is paid off, you can cash out of that probably pretty much tax-free.
And I understand that, and that's a very good point. I have no interest in selling and, like, trying to realize these gains. That's not an interest of mine, you know?
Okay.
My home is not an investment. It's simply a liability, in my opinion.
Okay.
It's just a place that I live. Right. It's just a place that I live. I don't look at it as an – I have investments. Mm-hmm. This is not an investment.
Okay.
So I'm just looking at the year-over-year changes. And to give you more context, you know, I live in suburbia. You know, I don't, you know, I've lived in New York City. I've lived in Los Angeles. I've lived in cities with real amenities.
Mm-hmm.
Where I live now, there's no amenities that are changing every year. It's just more in cost with no return for this cost. It's just raising value. And there's no, you know, there's no amenities.
Okay.
There's no amenities, no increased amenities. So,
okay. Have you started really looking at potential spots for you to relocate to?
No, I haven't. It has never been an interest of mine until I started listening to more of your content and understanding, man, you know, for every decision we make, there's also alternate decisions, you know, like I don't have to continue this path.
Right.
So I'm just thinking like, man, maybe I don't, not to say I don't deserve to live here, but maybe it, you know, maybe it's not the best financial place for me to be.
Yeah, I think you have a great point here. I think what you should be doing in your spare time, start looking at potential places where you can relocate. You know, obviously, if you were to sell your current property, how much could you get on that property? Because it's paid off. How much would it cost you to go somewhere where the property value is going to be a little bit less, so the property tax is going to be less, and what type of life could you have for yourself in that location? Your work is not going to change because you can work remotely, but yeah, I would say you need to seriously start running the numbers. You got the idea now, and it makes sense. Now run the numbers, and when you are able to put that down on paper and look and say, oh, okay, I can live in an area where I can basically have the same lifestyle that I have now, but the cost of living is less and the property tax is going to be less, I think I'm going to go ahead and do it. Even if, you know, the market is what the market is, we're starting to see housing prices kind of slow anyway, so you might get a good deal, but you need to start running the numbers and really taking a look at what is it going to cost to transfer from where you are to the new location that you want to go to.
Understood. Thank you.
Absolutely. You are welcome. Thank you for calling in. Good call. But yeah, that's what it is in life, people. You gotta think about what are your options. One of the worst things that people can do personally and professionally is to assume you have no options and just simply complain about whatever your particular current situation is. There's always an option. It may not be the thing that you like, or maybe you just need an outside opinion to help you think of some other things. But trust me, there's always options to move on from where you are. All right, here we go. We got caller from the 910 area code. Caller from 910. You are live on the air with Pocket Watching with JT. What's going on?
Hey there. I have a question. So like I do nursing contracts or whatever, and a lot of times the company offers like a 401k, and I normally use that, you know, and also I max out the Roth IRA through Fidelity with the 6,000.
Mm-hmm.
So, but for this current contract that I may take, they don't offer no type of a 401k or anything to put, you know, towards retirement at all. And I was calling to see like any ideas what to do, you know, to put something away, like as far as like an investment And look, a backdrop, like I was doing like 25% into a 401k, but then I dropped it down to 15% to put $1,000 extra on the principal of my home, to try to pay my home off.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little faster. So I was just like, man, because I don't want to go a year without putting nothing towards, you know, retirement. So I was thinking of a way to try to.
Well, how much did you normally put in the 401k when you had that option? Because for 2022, the total amount that you could put in there would have been, I believe, $20,500. So how much were you planning? Like, let's say you did have the 401k option. How much would you have planned to put in it this year?
Mm-hmm. Probably about a total of to 17 grand, I think. The 15 to 20% of my income, it'd been like 15 to 17,000.
Okay.
Or something like that.
Now, you said that you do contracts. So are you being paid as a W-2 employee, yes, or are you being paid as a 1099 independent contractor?
Oh, I'm still W-2. I'm just travel nursing. But
okay.
So it's still W-2.
So it's still W-2. They're just not giving you a 401k option.
Right. If I do take this contract that's coming up.
Okay.
I'm the pay range is it's like 27 or 3,000 a week or whatever.
All right. So, I mean, based on what you're telling me, your ability to put money away in a tax deferred account, right, is limited, right? So you don't have the option of the 401k. Right. Like I said, you could do 20,500 with that. Right now, the only option, because you are a W-2 employee, you're not self-employed. Now, if you were self-employed and it was a contract where you were self-employed, then we could talk about you setting up a SEP IRA, or you can set up a solo 401k through your business, right, being self-employed. But since you're not self-employed and they're not giving you a 401k option, you're limited to the $6,000 that you can put, because I'm assuming you're under 50 years old, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So you're limited to the $6,000 of a traditional or Roth IRA. That difference that you normally would have put into a retirement account, you may just want to put that into a brokerage account. I mean, you're investing. It's not going to be tax deferred in the sense with the 401k. You're not going to get a tax deduction for putting that money into a brokerage account, but you don't get a tax deduction for the Roth. But also the difference is with the Roth, you're not getting tax on the growth of the money when you pull it out at 59 and a half, where with the brokerage account, yeah, you're going to be taxed on the growth of that money when you pull it out. But the difference is you don't have to wait till you're 59 and a half. You can pull it out when you feel like it, when you need it, and there's no penalties. And you're going to be taxed at capital gains. Capital gains is 0%, which you're higher than that. You're probably not going to be taxed at the 0%, but it's 0%, 15, and 20. You're most likely in the 15% tax bracket with that. And still, if this is money that you don't plan on using for the next 20, 30 years, I mean, you're going to be fine. So I would say, hey, if you still plan on investing this money, even though you're limited to your options of a retirement account to invest this money, open up a brokerage account, contact the local certified financial planner that can kind of help you with, you know, how you're going to do that and what your investing portfolio, your investment portfolio is going to look like, what's best to do. But you may just want to, for this year, until you can get into an employment situation to set up a 401k, you probably would just want to open up a brokerage account and put it in there.
Okay, I appreciate that.
All right, boss, I appreciate you calling in. You have a good one, okay?
You too.
All right, here we go. We are going to caller from 703 area code. Caller from 703, you are live on the air with Pocket Watching with JT. How can I help you?
Hey, what's up, JT? Thanks for taking my call. It's an honor, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
I'll be brief. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll be brief. I just really have two questions.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll get off and hear your response offline. But One, I wanted to know who are some of your major influences in terms of, you know, people who have shaped your ideas about money, and also, you know, people who have sort of, I guess, fueled your passion for financial education. I think that'll be interesting also, you know, for, you know, all the listeners to hear, you know, people who have sort of inspired you so that, you know, we can sort of get, you know, some of those tips as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then my second question is also sort of like on a personal level, and, you know, you can feel free to run from it if you want, but,
okay.
You know, I just want to know where you stand politically. You know, like, are you a Trump supporter, traditional Republican, Democrat? You know, how do you define yourself politically, and why? So, you know, those are my two questions. I'll take your response offline. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for calling in. I'm going to hit them one by one, just as you asked them. So, question number one, who were my major influences? The number one is a tough one. The model is my father. My father's not a public figure. He hasn't wrote any books. So it's going to be extremely hard, you know, to help out the general pocket watcher. But my father is a major influence in my life. You're talking about a guy who started life below the poverty line, someone who did not have nearly the advantages that he and my mother was able to afford me, but a person who has achieved a lot in life. A lot of my characteristics, my math skills and stuff like that come directly from my father. Work ethic, even the way to think about a particular situation. I mean, I remember watching The Godfather with my father as a young boy and watching the relationship between Michael and Vito Corleone and just seeing that dynamic and how that played out in my life with me and my father. So that's the huge, I mean, you're talking about over 85%. Over 85% of who I am comes from the way that my father thinks and his mindset. And it's huge. I mean, a man who put me in a position to be, you know, a bookkeeper for the family business since the age of 9, and the way that he gave me certain responsibilities in my life at a young age that shaped me and my understanding of how life really works. You know, you don't just get what you want because you want it. You have to actually earn things. Like, money does not grow on trees, but there's ways that you have to make certain sacrifices to get the things that you want. That comes from him. So there's that. There's also Thomas Sowell. I mean, if I would suggest that a lot of you Google who Thomas Sowell is. He's got a lot of content on YouTube from various sources. Various sources. Not like you can find, you know, Thomas Sowell's YouTube channel. I mean, he probably has one, but trust me, if you put Thomas Sowell into YouTube, you'll find a lot of content. This is, an economics professor and someone that is a giant when it comes to just financial and political thought. Thomas Sowell is a giant. So I would suggest people Google him and you can get an idea of some of where my thinking come from on that side of it. So that's question number one. Question number two, political. I'm a moderate, man. I'm a believer in being a free agent. I think one of the worst things that you can do is commit your vote to a particular person or to a particular party, no matter what, right? So as a financial advisor, I can tell you one of the greatest things to happen to professional athletes is free agency. Like, today, we can see the blockbuster contracts that athletes get. And it's somewhat normal to us. We hear that so-and-so just signed for $125 million with X amount of money guaranteed. And it sounds almost normal to us today. But not too long ago, there was no free agency, really, right? It wasn't a bidding war. You basically stayed with your team, or you got cut and you went, or you got traded. It was a different thing. For anybody to automatically, regardless of what the platform of whatever party you pick, if you're not being choosy, if you're not looking and saying, who is going to offer me the things that serve my best interest the most, I think you're losing out politically. So you should always be, to me, a moderate, someone that's going to look and evaluate both sides of any party or any local election. I think the local side is what affects you the most. People are always too concerned about the national elections, but the local elections is what hits you in the pocketbook the most. If you're saying, I'm going to vote blue no matter what, or I'm going to vote red no matter what, I think you're losing out. So politically, I'm moderate. I'm an independent. But financially, I'm absolutely conservative. And I was trained that way because any good accountant, any good financial advisor is going to be fiscally conservative, because that makes sense. Having a balanced budget, making sure that you are spending less than you make, and making sure that you're also investing for the future and not putting a lot of debt and leaving your kids. The only thing you left your kids was debt to inherit isn't the best plan as an individual or as a country. So, you know, that's what I look at. Well, I mean, I agree on things that come from the left, and I agree on certain things that come from the right. I don't think either side is 100% correct, but I don't believe anybody is 100% correct on anything. Like, see, that's the difference. That's when you should know that you're in a cult. If you believe that somebody or some organization that you support is 100% correct, it's never wrong, you need to check yourself. You're in a cult. If the group that you're in, if you ever question what's going on, you say, I agree with about 80% of what y'all talking about, but just 20% over here, I don't agree with it. And that side shouts you down. That side is basically telling you that you are against them because you don't agree with 20% of what they're saying. That's what cults do. And, you know, I'm not in this to be in a cult. Hey, we got Lucchese 20 in the building. Says, excellent advice about being generally moderate and financially conservative. Local elections are indeed, local elections, look, all politics is local. Politics and real estate have one thing in common. It's all about what's going on locally. What's going on locally? If you only vote during presidential elections, you're missing out in life. You are really 100%, you're missing out in life. You got to make sure what's going on locally, be it the school board, anything, your local city council. Those are the type of things that matter, especially if you're a business owner. If you have no connections politically as a business owner, how are you going to get things done? You need to be able to have some influence politically, especially if you're a business owner, but also if you're just, you know, a normal everyday citizen that wants to be able to get things done. You need to be a moderate. You need to be someone who's willing to find who's going to give them the biggest bang for your vote. If someone can always count on your vote, why do they need to serve you? Just think about this for a second. Think about this for a second. If you can 100% guarantee that I'm going to vote for you, no matter what you do, why would you ever appeal to my demands? If I'm saying, hey, you know, I think I need more money for my community to go into the schools and do certain like financial literacy programs, they'll say, okay, but I think I'm going to give the money to this other person who I don't have their vote guaranteed, because you're going to vote for me no matter what. I've got to allocate my funds and my energy and my effort to people who actually could vote for the other side. I think it's a basic thing, but you know, you're talking to a kid that in 1992-ish, my father sent me to school. I think it was election day. My father sent me to school with a Ross Perot pen. So you're talking to someone who I've been doing this for a while. And I just feel like common sense is to just look at what's going on, evaluate both sides before you do. I got to do this for clients. Understand this. Let's say I've got a client who is evaluating two different employment options, right? They got two different deals on the table. One company they like a lot, or they've been working there for a long time. The other company they've never really worked for a lot. They don't know the environment for with that company, as far, you know, about work-life environment. But I would be a fool not to at least evaluate the deal that both companies are offering. Even if you're not comfortable with it, like, I don't even know those guys over there. Yeah, but they're offering you 35% more. They're giving you everything that this other group is, but they're offering you 35% more. And we can always go over there and see what the work-life balance is about, interview some of the other people, but to just throw the offer off and look like I'm not even going to entertain it, you're limiting your options. And it's always my job, any good financial advisor's job, is to give that client as many options as possible, but then recommend what they think is best. But ultimately, it's the client's job to pick it. All right, so here we go. I am going to go to some of these questions that y'all send me. So you can go to pocketwatcher.net, click the Ask JT button, and you can submit your questions online if you do not have the time or the ability to call in. So I'm going to go through some of these, and we're going to wrap things up. So here we go. I got a caller from Beast Mode, Beast Mode 86. Beast Mode says, what's the overall percentage in taxes that someone supposed to pay each year when self-employed, and what could be considered write-off? All right, so Beast Mode, there's some variables here. So since you are self-employed, automatically, I'm assuming you're self-employed in the situation where you're not probably cutting yourself a W-2. So just know on the net income that you're going to be making, you're going to be paying 15.3% in what's referred to as self-employment tax. That self-employment tax is going to cover your Social Security and Medicare tax that normally would come out of your payroll. But there is no payroll, you're self-employed. And generally, you only pay half of that when you're a W-2 employee. The employer pays the other half. But because you're self-employed, you have to pay the full amount, which comes to 15.3%. But don't worry too much about that, because half of that, you get the write-off on the personal side as an adjustment to income, but you still have to pay the full amount. So just know 15.3% you need to put off to the side for self-employment tax. Then you also have federal income tax. Self-employment tax, federal income tax, two different things. Even though you're still sending the money to the same place, it's two different things. So you got 15.3% that you're dealing with self-employment tax. You have probably, I have to assume, if your business is doing any type of decent money where you're able to take care of yourself, you're probably somewhere in the 22 to 24% tax bracket. Now, that's on your net taxable income, your taxable income, not your gross income, because you're going to have certain write-offs on the personal side, right? So let's say the business nets $100,000. Let's do this for a second. If the business nets $100,000 after all of your expenses, just know you're going to be looking at like almost $15,000, a little over $15,000 of self-employment tax. Got that. But about $7,500 you can deduct from the $100,000 on the personal income tax side, because that's going to be an adjustment to income. Then you also have the qualified business income deduction that's going to be about 20% of that $100,000. Then you also have either your itemized personal deductions, which would be your mortgage interest that you pay, charity that you pay, state and local income tax up to $10,000 at the most. You got your itemized personal deductions, or you take the standard deduction, right? It's less than $13,000 if you're single. It's a little less than $25,000 if you are married filing joint. And it's less than $20,000 if you are head of household, meaning that you have a dependent and you're single and not married. So you've got all those deductions on the federal income tax side to get down to what's ultimately going to be your actual taxable income, right? You got gross income, you got adjusted gross income, then you have those deductions that I just talked about to get to your federal income, taxable income, and then that will be taxed at whatever tax bracket that you fall into. So as a general rule of thumb, I tell clients, especially the ones that are just starting out, it's probably best to keep about 20 to 25% off to the side to take care of your self-employment tax, your federal income tax, your state income tax, because most states have a state income tax, and you may live in a city with a local income tax. The city of St. Louis and also Kansas City has a 1% local income tax. So about 20 to 25%, if you put that off to the side, you should be good. And the second part of your question where you asked about what could be considered write-offs, I say this all the time. The IRS has two words when it comes to what is a legitimate business expense. It's going to be something that is ordinary and necessary for your industry. I don't know what you do. So, you know, it could be different for a different industry, right? What's ordinary and necessary for a financial advisor is going to be different for a plumber or, you know, an actor. So ordinary and necessary for your industry. As long as it covers those two things, that's a write-off. As long as you're spending money in the attempt to make money within your business and it's ordinary and necessary, and it's not a personal expense that you're trying to hide as if it's a business expense, you're probably going to be fine. All right, so that's that one. We got another caller that I'm going to try to get through some of these 22 pages. But let me go to the caller here. We got a caller from the 302 area code. Make sure whatever device you're listening to me, go ahead and turn that down. Talk to me straight through the phone, and I'm going to bring you on now. Here we go. Caller from 302 area code. You're live on the air with Pocket Watching with JT. How can I help you?
Hi, JT. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for calling.
Great. So I have a question. Mm-hmm. I have a son who is 5, and he is medically complex. He's like always going to need, he's never going to be able to live independently.
Okay.
So my question is, what would you recommend, or are there any sort of like savings accounts or anything like that that I can invest in or deposit into now that may grow tax deferred? I don't know, like maybe some sort of flex spending account. What is there out there for individuals and their families who are in this situation?
Okay. This is like a textbook question when it comes to like the CFP exam. This is literally something that I probably answered easily a couple hundred times while studying for the CFP exam. Based on the general information that you gave me, what you probably want to do is going to be somewhat two-parted. Since you already know that your dependent, your son, will never be in a position where he will be able to take care of himself financially, you're probably, mm-hmm. This is one of the rare instances where you will hear me say you may want to look into getting a whole life insurance policy on yourself and get a right within your will, right within your will, have a trust set up so that your son would be the beneficiary of the trust. And then you would have someone who, after you are now gone, be the trustee over that trust to make sure that he would be able to have access to this money, that it's spent wisely. That's one side of it. Okay. Because here's the deal.
Okay.
You are still, I'm assuming, in the process of investing for your own retirement.
Yes.
Right. So while you're investing for your own retirement, most people do not have the ability to save up enough for their own retirement where there's going to be money left over. Now, I do know many clients who do, but for the most part, your retirement plan is probably going to leave you kind of zeroing out or getting close to zeroing out whatever you have for yourself. And if that happens and you're zeroing out what you have for yourself, what's going to be left for your son? So the whole life insurance for your son being a beneficiary, and since he's not going to be able to truly manage the money on his own. That's why I say it probably would make sense. I don't think you need to get a trust now, because the issue is getting a trust now. There's administrative fees and making sure everything goes into it in the right place. I would say you could get a will, and a will's only going to cost you anywhere $300-$700, something like that. Have within the will that you want a trust to be created upon your passing, and the beneficiary of the life insurance policy could be the trust, and then your son would be the beneficiary of that trust, and then right within the will, how you want that money managed, right? So if it's a policy of $500,000 or, you know, whatever it is, have some sort of instructions on there of, you know, hey, this is how I would like to have that money invested, and this is how much I want allocated for his upkeep, you know, moving forward, things like that. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is, one, you still have to make sure that you're securing your retirement, right? So make sure you are focusing on your own retirement. And if there's something left after you have the life insurance and you're securing your own retirement, and there's still funds left to be able to invest, then you can simply just look at it and say, hey, if I can put more money in on your own investments and just make your son, or like I said before, the trust, the beneficiary of those funds when you are gone, then he's going to get that anyway. So looking for particular things individually for him may not be as necessary, because, you know, I could talk about certain accounts that you can set up and be the administrator of, but the thing is, he's never going to take those accounts, quote unquote, over. Right. Because like in a traditional sense, you'd be like, OK, I get an account where when my kid turns 18 or when they turn 21, they'll take it over. Your son's never going to take it over. The only time that he's going to need to have these funds is when you're gone, because otherwise you're always going to have, you're going to play a role in supporting your son until you're gone. And then that's where the estate planning comes into play. That's where the life insurance, that's where whatever remaining assets that you have for your retirement can go into the trust account to be added to the total amount of money that would be still there to help your son, you know, live moving forward. But also, I'm assuming all the other, you know, government benefits or anything that he, you know, is qualified for, you're seeking those out and taking advantage of those, right?
Yes, because I have two. I have an 8-year-old who he's fine and bright and healthy and intelligent. My husband passed away back in 2017, so the boys get survivor benefits.
Right.
So for the 8-year-old, I'm investing, like, pretty much as soon as it comes in, I'm putting it towards his 529.
Gotcha.
So that's not even a concern. So he's not trying to pay things off like his mom.
Gotcha.
But I was just wondering, because again, I'm doing things for him, but I know that for my younger son, I need to kind of, you know what path to take with.
Yeah, I would say, reach out to a CFP in your area, and they can help you kind of figure out the best plan, how much of insurance that you're really going to need, and what's the best use of the benefits that he's currently getting, what would make sense for the overall picture. But normally, if you know, you give me this question on an exam, I'm probably going to say that whole life insurance needs to play a role, unless you're independently wealthy, and then there's certain things that you can do to self-insure in case something was to happen to you. But in a general sense, whole life insurance in this particular situation makes the most sense, because he'll never be in a situation where he'd be able to financially take care of himself. And if you go and like your any annuity payments that you get, like Social Security, you know, those type of things are somewhat limited, but the life insurance, he'd be able to get, it's tax-free money, and it has an, you know, ability to, you know, to grow in the trust account if invested properly, well, he'll be able to survive for the rest of his days somewhat comfortably, you know, with those funds.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
You are absolutely welcome. Thanks for calling in.
Absolutely. Take care.
You too. All right. Where we go? All right. I'm gonna read a couple more questions. Unless someone calls in, I'm gonna read a couple more questions from pocketwatcher.net, ask JT. And then we're gonna wrap this episode up. So let me see here. I got a question from Musa. Musa says, can you buy a new vehicle under your EIN number for Uber or Delivery? Is it possible to write off some of the expenses for the vehicle as well? All right, so this is a general question that most business owners ask, especially if you use a vehicle in your business. Yes, you can buy a vehicle in the name of the business. But the thing is, it sounds like you're trying to finance it, right? It's not just buying it, you're trying to finance it. You're probably going to try to get a vehicle that you can't pay off in cash. You're looking for a way to get a loan on it. Here's the issue about that is, does the business by itself have enough business credit for you to buy this vehicle? Most likely not, right? Just basing on the question, the business itself probably does not have enough credit for you to simply buy the vehicle with it, with the EIN number without personally guaranteeing the car note. So yes, you still can though. You're probably going to end up having to personally guarantee the loan, even though it's in the business name and the EIN number. But when you say Uber or Delivery, my question is, is this 100% business use or not? If it's not 100% business use, honestly, I don't feel it's necessary to get it in the business name if it's not 100% business use. Because at the end of the day, if it's not 100% business use, there's going to be certain limitations of what you can write off. Honestly, most of the time when people ask this question, they're probably to just go ahead and just get the car that they want. Because they got an idea of the car that they want. We're not talking about a dump truck or a tow truck or something like that. We're talking about a car that you're going to be driving, you know, in your personal life that you can also drive for Uber. Well, okay, yeah, just get the car that you want, that you can afford, you know, that you want and can afford, those two things put together, and you still can be able to write off certain expenses for the car that you're using in the business, right? You can write off mileage, right? You can either do mileage or you can do actual expenses that are related to the business, right? So not talking about every time you fill up your gas tank, we're talking about times that you fill up your gas tank for business related stuff, repairs that are business related repairs. So you can either do the actual expenses that happen based on the business, or you could take a look at mileage, but mileage that are made based on the business, not just because you're driving, mileage that is based on the business. So unless it's 100% business use, just get the car. Just get the car, because the thing is, you don't want to try to pass off personal expenses as if they're business expenses. Don't go down that lane. You don't want to do that. All right, we got one more caller and we're going to wrap this thing up. We got caller from the 813 area code. Caller from 813. You are live on the air with Pocket Watching with JT. How can I help you?
Hey, JT. Thanks for having me on, man.
Sure.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about self-directed IRA.
Okay.
So I got a self-directed IRA recently.
Uh-huh.
And when I was researching it, it sounded...
Uh-oh. You still there? I see you on the line, but I can't hear you anymore. You got to check and see if you... If you muted yourself, what I'm going to do here, I'm going to take you off live and put you back in the queue and give you a second while I explain to people what we're talking about. So an IRA, right, an individual retirement account is what we were talking about a couple of callers ago. This is a retirement account that you normally would get in a situation where you don't have a 401k option with your employer, right? Because that option gives you way more money that you could put away for retirement. Remember, we're talking about $20,500 that you can put in annually, right? With an IRA, you can only put in $6,000. If you're over 50, you can put in a bonus $1,000 to get you to $7,000. But you see the difference there. Being able to put away $20,500 every year and putting away $6,000 is a big difference there. So if you have an option for the 401k, you can do more work each year putting away and investing. So what is a self-directed IRA? Well, traditionally, if you just get a regular IRA, then you're going to be limited to the investment options that the investment company that you're using to set up your IRA with, right? Which is traditionally going to be like stocks and bonds and stuff like that. With a self-directed IRA, you have more latitude in what you can invest. Now, there's certain things you can invest in, right? You can't invest in like collectibles. Like, nah, the IRS isn't going to allow you to invest in collectibles for your self-directed IRA. Another thing that you can't invest in, collectibles, was precious metals. There you go. I'm pretty sure there's certain like precious metals and stuff that you, I don't think you can do. Do I got it right? There's something in there where I think that there's certain things you can't do. But normally, when it comes to self-directed IRAs, people are really interested in real estate. That's normally the question. Let me see if the caller's back on to see if that's what they're calling about. Are they asking about real estate in the self-directed IRA? All right, caller from 813. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay.
I heard your question. Yeah, so I wanted to use it because, well, first of all, I recently looked some stuff up and saw that a lot of businesses, like, where do people get the money to start their businesses? A lot of business owners go into their 401k to start their business. So I thought that part was interesting. Mm-hmm. But I got mine for the purpose of real estate investing. So it's, you know, if you use like a self-directed Roth, for example, you can invest it in a real estate project. It can't be something that you benefit from personally. And then as the value of that property goes up, that the IRA is owned by the property. So the value of the IRA goes up as well.
Yeah, but okay. Yes, in general. So just to be clear, so with a self-directed IRA, you can fund that IRA like you would normally fund the IRA with dollars. But being self-directed, you can actually, instead of just being limited to traditional asset classes as far as stocks, bonds, mutual funds, stuff like that, you can buy real estate. Now, here's the big pocket watcher warning when it comes to this. Real estate is obviously a traditional and good investment class to invest in, but real estate has certain variables that is not like stocks and bonds and mutual funds. You can buy a property and your general contractor can say, oh, if you have a budget of $80,000, we'll have everything done. Then they can come back to you maybe a few months later or whatever and say, you know what? We thought $80,000 was going to do it, but you're really going to need $120,000. Now, in the normal world of real estate investing, you take it on the chin and you pay up the additional money that needs to be paid. But you can't do that in a self-directed IRA because you're still limited to the funding requirements. So we're talking about, again, $6,000 a year. So if you have a limit of $6,000 a year to invest in this self-directed IRA, and you're gauging based off a particular budget, and you don't have the additional money if that contractor or whoever tells you, oh, I'm sorry, we got something wrong. We actually need more money. Well, you can't put more than that annual $6,000 in there. You just can't do it. You're limited. So what happens? The project is over budget. You can't put more than $6,000 in. What happens? Well, you're probably going to end up losing the project because you can't overfund the IRA, because if you do, you are going to get kicked in the teeth when it comes to the penalties of overfunding it. So I normally tell anyone who's planning on investing in real estate in a self-directed IRA, you have to make sure that you have that thing funded way over any potential adjustments to what the real estate budget may be. Because if you're caught with your pants down and you don't have enough money to cover the difference, it can completely blow up that account. you'll end up having to sell or whatever at a discount, and it's going to throw off what potentially was your retirement plan. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. I didn't consider that going into that, so that's definitely good to know. No, thank you.
Yeah, because it could be a good plan. So that, now that I talked about the worst case scenario, I want the pocket watchers, the people who are paying attention. Well, what's good about this? You just told me all the bad things that could happen. What's the good thing? Well, the good thing is with this, it's a Roth account. So we're talking about having annual rent, right? If you've got, let's say you got some sort of four unit complex and you've got these monthly rental payments coming in that obviously turn into annual rental payments coming in, and you retire. Now you're 59 and a half and you're retired. That income is coming to you tax-free because you've already paid money on the principal. This was a Roth account, a self-directed Roth account, but this was a Roth account, and you can be in retirement getting rental income 100% tax-free because you had these assets in the Roth account. So that's best case scenario. I just want to make sure people are aware of what could go wrong and make sure that you have it properly funded. Normally in a situation like this, you might want to try to do a rollover, right? So if you have a lot in a traditional retirement account or 401k, let's say you got like $300,000-$400,000 in a traditional, then you roll it over into the Roth, know that you're getting taxed on the year that you roll it over. But you roll it over and now you have a much larger budget when it comes to how much you can use for the self-directed IRA. That's one thing. But if you're trying to get this thing done by just putting $6,000 in each year, it's going to take you some time. But with the traditional 401k, if you're putting in $20,500 each year, it's not going to take you that long to get up to $100,000, $200,000. And then roll it over into a self-directed IRA. Now, I'm not saying everybody should do this because everybody's not meant to be landlords and understand the difference in that, but I'm just saying that's an option that I would suggest that you contact a local CFP and see if that works out for you.
Yeah, and JT, I got one more quick thing. Mitt Romney had a $1 billion 401k and Peter Thiel had a $1 billion Roth. Are those stories true? Have you heard anything similar to billionaires using this strategy?
I got to look into it off the top of my head. I'm kind of tired off the top of my head. Those stories doesn't kick off anything in my mind that I remember, but it's late and I can't think of it, but it's not something that I can think of off the top of my head, but I will write a note. And if I remember something, I'll take a look at it. I might mention it on a later show. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. You have a great night. All right, Pocket Watchers, we're going to call it a show. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. Hit the like button, share this type of content. We are going to, of course, be right back Wednesday night, 8 p.m. with my brother, Mr. Orlando Miner, for the Wednesday night live stream. And this Friday, we will be back in the radio studio of News Talk STL, broadcasting live on the radio station. And, of course, broadcasting on YouTube. You guys be on the lookout for that. I really enjoy those shows, the Change My Mind series, and obviously Money Mondays and the Wednesday night ones. But be prepared to have some fun this coming Friday. That's all I'm gonna say. I'll put out the thumbnail of what Friday's show is gonna be about, but be prepared to call in early if you want to get on the show. But we're gonna have some fun Friday night at 8 p.m. Central Standard Time. Big shout out to all of my YouTube members. Thank you guys so much for clicking that join button on this YouTube channel and contributing to what we do here at Pocket Watching with JT. Everybody on the screen, thank you so, so much for supporting this content. I will see you guys Wednesday at 8 p.m. Central Standard Time. Y'all have a great night.